everyone. Jason Shattuck here with PremierGuitar.com, and we are here with Vince Gill and Paul Franklin. We're actually in Vince's studio at his house, where you guys recorded your latest album, Bakersfield. And today we're going to look at some of the instruments, some of the guitars, and take a quick look at kind of the studio and where you guys recorded that. So thanks a lot for inviting us to your place, Vince.
Welcome.
All right, first, Paul, let's start over here with your pedal steel. So tell us a little bit about this pedal steel, kind of the tunings and how you used it on the album.
Okay, well, this is a Franklin pedal steel guitar. My father has made steel guitars since I was 16. Mm-hmm. So, and anyway, so this is a double neck. It's what they call the E9th, a double 10-string guitar, E9th and C6 tunings. And it's a Formica covered guitar, and much like the Emmons, which is one of the cornerstones of steel players prefer either an all wood finish like an old Showbud that size, or they prefer the Formica covered with aluminum necks like mm-hmm. the old Emmons push pull it was called. And this is not a copy of that, but it has enough of that sonic texture to give you that twang when you need it, and it has a lot of sustain. Mm-hmm. And then the pedal setup that I prefer is much like a Buddy Emmons basic setup. The first three floor pedals are Buddy's setup, which raises 5 and 10, the Bs, a whole tone, 3 and 6, which is the G sharps to A, a half a tone. And then the third pedal raises the E to F sharp and the B to C sharp, mm-hmm. a whole tone. And that's the typical, what we call the Buddy Emmons pedal. That was the original when the pedal steel started, and they started getting into playing all that traditional stuff back in the 60s. Those are the three main pedals. Mm-hmm. Then knee levers were added, and I have, I raise the E's to F, and then lower the major seventh of the chord to a dominant seventh, and then down to a sixth. And I also, on that same lever, drop the dominant seventh that's in the bottom, so I can make like a minor seventh or a sixth, however you view that. And I have an up lever that's out of tune, which I will tune it really quick. But it does a unique. Now this is my own thing, but it raises the sixth string up a tone and a half. And there's a lot of piano, there's a lot of stuff like that I found myself in the 80s when I had to double a lot of piano parts. Piano players typically play those kind of voicings, so I put that on there to try to achieve some of that. And then the other part of the E9th, I lower the E's half a tone, and then I raise strings 1 and 2, like the top string is an F sharp note, it goes to G sharp, and then the second string goes from an E flat to an E, mm-hmm. and then the lower mm-hmm. F sharp goes from an F sharp to a G sharp. This is very out of tune, but so you can play more modern voicings. And that's the E9th. So I basically took Buddy's setup and added things that I felt were comfortable and have applied it over the years. But like the knee lever that raises E's to F, and that was, you could find that going back as far as the 60s. You know, the first time I ever heard it, Jimmy Day kind of did it on a thing. Speedy West, he played on the very first Loretta Lynn record, and he did, it's the intro, something like the. And the only way I know how you make that move is to raise those strings. So, it may go back as far as Loretta Lynn's first record. And then on the C6, now mine, again, I started out with the basic, what I call Buddy Emmons setup, which is on the C6, I have a D on top. It's D, E, C, A, G, E, C, A, F, C. And then I've... this is again out of tune, but the major 9 that Buddy used, I kept that. And then this pedal Buddy used, where it's I call it a dominant 9th pedal. And it raises the second string a half a tone, lowers the sixth string, a half a tone. Those are both E strings, but it takes them in opposite directions. And then the next pedal over, I lower the fifth string, which is the fifth of the chord, of the C chord, to get a flat five. And also raise the ninth string, which is an 11. And then raise it a half a tone, so it goes, so it fits that note very well. And then with that, you can play. You know, you can move it like that. It allows you to play. Buddy came up with this, and it was brilliant. And he did. There's a funny story about that, and you may not get to interview Buddy. So, but he shot built the first show, Bud. And Buddy had the E9 thing, and the guitar took off. And he said, Buddy, we got to build a double neck. What pedals should I put on it? Well, gee, they hadn't really thought about it. Pedals are just, you know, in their infancy. And so Buddy took about a week. And he thought about it, and he came up with all this brilliant pedal setup. Mm-hmm. And it still holds true today. I mean, I've thought about it many different ways, and I can't get rid of those pedals because it makes so much sense. Musically, with that flat five pedal, you've got the diminished. You know, you can make all these modern chords, and it's like, what was the guy on when overnight to just come up with that? But, you know, Buddy's probably everybody's favorite, and certainly, you know, the cornerstone of pedal steel guitar.
So a quick question for coming from a non-steel player is, how do you know when to play what neck on what tune? What kind of decisions do you need to make to, is it key or style? Or?
Well, I said I play steel guitar. I didn't say I knew what to play. no, you know what? As far as which neck to do, you know, you can play country on this neck. You can play jazz on this neck. But what really the song dictates.
Okay.
Like if I were going to play something like as we did in the Bakersfield, it had to be on this neck. Okay. Because that's where Ralph Mooney and those guys, let me get the right neck. It's got that twang, got that bite, it had to be there. So one of Vince's longtime steel guitar player, and the late great John Huey, and one of my mentors, he called this the Kroger neck. So, you know, it's like most of the stuff you end up, if you want to make a living, most of the stuff that you hear a steel guitar do is done on the E9th tuning. Mm-hmm. And this is, and that's including like all the Rusty Young stuff, and you know, everything from the Southern rock through. It's going to be a bass, something that's been either exactly this or it has been slightly altered for the players.
And you walk through the notes on the C6 next, but can you tell us what the tuning is on that one?
I will. It's F sharp, E flat, G sharp, E, B, G sharp, F sharp, E, D, and B. And most guitarists will automatically go, well, why are these two strings on top? And when the steel guitar first started out, it was eight string. Fender made an eight string pedal steel guitar. And Ralph Mooney ended up putting this high string on. And he was on the West Coast. Now, you got to remember, there's before the internet and all the communication thing. And he put this, that sound on a Buck Owens record somewhere. Emmons and Day heard it. And they're in Nashville. And they're like, well, we got to have that. They figured out what it was instantly by using it. But they had to put it somewhere. So the story was that Buddy put it down. He was on the road, so he just said, well, I'll put it on the bottom. I'm not using this in the Ray Price show, so he put it down on the bottom string because he wasn't using it and played those licks, and he thought, wow, that's really cool, so it's got to be up here. Mm-hmm. So he got rid of whatever their low string was and then ended up transferring it over there. And then he came up, after that came up, then they thought, well, boy, we need the other notes of the scale, which are these. And so there was no way, they didn't want to alter, like if you think of all the mechanical work you would have to do to stick those in the diatonic order, it was just, that's too much work. So he just added two more strings on the outside.
I see.
And just got used to the same way that he could reach down and grab that other string. He thought, well, I'll just grab those notes out there. Mm-hmm. And it stuck. And, you know, I don't know of anybody that's changed it from that. But that's the E9th tuning.
So was this the steel used on the album as well?
This is the one I used on the record, yes.
Can you demonstrate a little a bit of how you kind of cop those sounds on that album? And tell me a little bit about kind of this along with your amp setup as well.
Okay. Well, like...
Now tell us a little bit. I saw you slant the bar there for, you know, okay, for non-steel players. Can you explain that a little
bit? Okay, that's from Hawaiian music. You know, the before pedals, they used to go... They used to make pedal sounds. Jerry Bird did this brilliantly. But, so all I did was... I just made a seventh. The pedal gives you... Here's your... That's your third and your fifth. And then I just take the slant to give the seventh. So I'm sliding back from a... And you would resolve right there with both pedals down. But since this is a seventh, I just it's a gift because I would never think this up, but I can analyze it. then I just happened the night that I first played this, I just went to another seventh position to resolve it. So that's on the beginning of the solo on Together Again. And that's all it is.
Excellent. Well, tell us a little bit now about your effects down there next to you and how you kind of incorporate that with the pedal steel.
Okay. Well, you know, most of the stuff, I think that from a no matter what type of session you do, mm-hmm. I think most producers and most situations you get in, they'll want the purest sound you can give them, mm-hmm. unless you're going for like a heavy metal tone or something like that. You're going to want try to get the cleanest.
Do you get called for a heavy metal steel guitar every once in a while?
Lately. So what I do is I just add a little bit of reverb. Justin Niebanks is a great musician, and he was engineering this project, mm-hmm. and he likes reverb, and he allowed me to add more probably than most people would, which I loved. But anyway, I use this little Bonato effects board. It's called the Steel Dream, and he's got a great sound and little reverb in there, and I just put in about that much when I recorded the record, and nothing else. You know, there's the other thing that's in this pedal, there's an echo pedal, which is very good, and I'll just kick that in so sometimes I'll just put that much echo so it's still. Of course, you can do, you know, you can put a longer repeat. If you're doing more pop, you might just make sounds. You can get a lot of things out of that pedal. But I bet 90% of everything I do is just a little reverb, the guitar, and into the amp. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. And then what you can do is if you're after ethereal sounds or whatever, you can grab your favorite pedals and you can hook them in. But I think when you record the steel guitar, it can get really muddy real fast if you run it through gear after gear and you lose the nuance of what the instrument itself is. Mm-hmm. So what my approach to it has always been, just I plug in whatever I need for the song. And I would always do that. Most stuff goes as same with guitar. You either decide it goes before the volume pedal or after the volume pedal, depending on how you want it to respond to the instrument. Mm-hmm. But and then I use a little Walter amp head. This is a 50 watt. This is the VG model, he calls it. But it's got a...
What's VG stand for?
Very good.
Okay.
it's just got a volume, a treble, and a bass. And that's all there is to it. There's no reverb in the amp, which is why I use the Bonato Steel Dream.
It looks like you keep the treble... up and
on this particular this is the bass.
Oh, okay.
This particular model really does emulate like a great in between a twin and a deluxe, mm-hmm. on the steel, but it's got a lot of bite, and which I love, and that's really it. You know, if I need it, I mean, I can darken it, but I can't darken it a lot, and that would be more like a Nashville, like a Let me get closer to where I can play the guitar. So it's really thick. But I usually, I like the sample because I like the little, that twang, you know, I like that, that bite. And it gives me that, and what I love about the little Walter amp is, hear this there, I can, no matter where I go, it never gets shrill. You know, and what I've found in the past years, of just buying vintage amps or whatever, tube amps, I would really have to, if I got it to where it wasn't so bright up here, it'd be a little bit too muddy down here. And then I'll hit you a bottom string. It's got the clarity in the bottom end, mm-hmm. even though it has that nice ringing thing. And that's, it's for me, it's that amp has changed my life. I used to have to constantly switch and try to find ways to get, you know, change my tonal settings to play this neck when I did, and you know, and you still will do some of that, but you know, if I'm on a live gig, I can play that amp and pretty much cover what I need to cover.
And tell me a little bit about what gauge strings and a little about the picks you use as well.
Okay, well, you know, I think these are called Blue Herco thumb picks, I think H-E-R-C-O, and I just got used to these as a kid. And it's the only thing I feel comfortable playing with. And I use, these are Jeff Newman copies. You get them from jeffermusic.com, but they're copies of the old original National mm-hmm. picks. And that's just what I've always used, and I love them. I know there are a lot of other great picks, and it's just, I think that, just whatever you become comfortable with, whatever fits nice. And strings, I use D'Addario strings.
And what gauge are you using?
Oh, okay, I got to think. 13 on the E9th for the first string, 13, 15, 12, 15, 18, 20 playing, and then it's a 24, 30, 34, 36. Mm-hmm. No, wait, it's a 38, excuse me. It's a 38. And then on the C6, it's a 17, 15, 18, 20, 26, 30, 36, 42, 54, 70.
Mm. So much heavier on that.
Much heavier, mm-hmm. yes.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for walking us through all your sounds. Paul, we're going to go over here and talk to Vince now. All right, Vince.
What?
Oh, sorry.
What?
So this is kind of your main telly, mm-hmm. and one you've used for quite a while. Why don't you tell us a little bit, for people who aren't familiar, kind of the history of this guitar and how you came across it.
Okay, this is a 53 Fender Telecaster. I bought it in 1979, I think, maybe 1980. I had been looking for one for a long time, and my collecting of instruments started very, very slow, and I couldn't afford a whole lot of guitars back in the day, and little by little I've built a really pretty amazing collection. But this guitar was in a trade, an old fellow at a music store in Del City, Oklahoma. I grew up in Oklahoma City, and this was a little music store on the outskirts of Oklahoma City. And this guy had a great old school store. He's the kind of guy, his name was Bob Woods, and he would sell PAs to churches and kids that let them buy guitars on time. And he just was the neatest old guy, really old school music store. And he had gone into a trade with a guy named Larry Briggs from Tulsa, who was a great vintage instrument guy, still doing it, and a longtime friend of mine. And they went and had a big swap of about 20 or 30 guitars. Mm-hmm. I'll trade you these 15 for these 20, and da-da-da, and this trade went down. You know, and I was in the shop just knocking around, and I saw this old guitar go by, and Bob had taken it in on trade. And Larry left, and I said, "Hey, man, you pulled an old telly in that trade." I said, "Would you sell it?" He goes, "Yeah." And I said, "How much?" And he said, $450. I said, "Sold." You know, and so I gave him the money, and this guitar has been with me, you know, about every night since. It's the one guitar that I think am probably the most known for, but also the most drawn to. And it's a magical sounding guitar. I've never heard. I've got several other Blackguard Telecasters that I've picked up over the years, and I've never found one that can really hold its own with this one. This is a really rare piece, and my dear friend Joe Glazer, who does a lot of instrument repair for everybody here in town, probably one of the best luthiers in the country, he himself has proclaimed it the best one he's ever seen. So for whatever that's worth, it is to me, you know, because he's seen most all the other ones of all the greats, and it just has something that's just its own thing. You know, like I said, I got a bunch of other ones, and none of them quite have the spank and the sustain and the whatever it is about this one. This one's a sweeter sounding Telecaster than most, I think. Sometimes Telecasters can be a little bit bright.
Now, when you were in that store, was it something like as soon as you first picked it up, it felt good and sounded good, or did you kind of want to get it because it was at the right price, and then later on you find out you're like, no, this is really special?
Well, I mean, it was, you know, I got it a little bit cheaper than it might have been worth in 1979 or 1980. I don't think an old Telecaster was probably going to go for more than $700 or $800 back then, so as good a buy as it was, it did feel great in my hands. Interesting thing about old Telecasters is neck profiles year by year are very, very different. You know, I have some that are older than this, and the necks are bigger, and I really have a hard time with a bigger neck. And a lot of times I'll find an old guitar but won't be interested in it just because the neck doesn't feel, I don't have big hands, and this just, you know, there's something about it that it just was magical in my hands.
Have you, since you've had it all these years, has it ever been refretted? Have you ever changed anything on it? Or
I've had to refret it, I think, several times over the years. I've worn them out and burned them up. A trick I learned years and years ago from Roy Nichols told me when he found out I was a Tele player, and he said, one thing most Tele players won't do is roll the tone back when you're playing on the back pickup. And this made the most sense to me. That's with the tone all the way up. And if you roll, there's a lot of top. It's not very pleasing. And then you get that top really, really loud. And that's why most of us are deaf. But if you'll take that and roll it back, just listen to how it takes that really gacky top. And
it's not that clarity in it.
Yeah, and it's still plenty bright, you know, but what it does to the top strings sweetens them, you know, versus, it's amazing, you know, just that little bit of difference, and you just roll it back until that really brittle sound goes away, and with that you can brighten your amp a little bit.
How do you normally set kind of your amps when you're, does that change with guitar, or does that change with, do you kind of set it and just leave it?
I play with a drummer named Billy Thomas who's deaf, so I just have to play loud enough to be louder than him. So it's pretty loud. Yeah. Now we go at it pretty hard. You know, I think that it's fun when music's cranked up. It really, you know, it hits you, and I always have my amps on stage. I don't do in-ears, I don't do any of that, so we put forth a lot of, we push a lot of air on that stage.
Good. All right, let's take a look at the next guitar. All right, Vince, so it looks like here we have a thin line Tele, so tell us a little bit about this one.
This is a guitar that I've had for quite some time. I can't even remember where I picked it up. But this is, you know, for a mid-60s, late-60s Tele, it's a remarkable sounding guitar, and I'm so grateful that this guitar was saved. This guitar was in the flood. We had the flood here in 2010, and this guitar was in pretty bad shape. All of the top, as you can see, was cracked and split apart. And Joe and all of his guys, Joe Glazer once again, saved this instrument. The cap of the neck was lifted and had come off. And the fact that I got to keep this, you know, was like, and save it. Was a great thrill, because I lost about 40 instruments in that flood, maybe 50, and bunch of old cases and whatnot. And I think these guitars, you know, they sound so much different to me because of the F hole, and just their design is a little bit different. I don't know that I think they sound better than an old Blackguard, but they just have a different. I think the 60s Telecasters had a different kind of honk in them. You know, they had more mid-range and had a different thing. Like this guitar, I have tuned down a whole step, so it's down to, you know, to D instead of E. And
did you tune down this for a song on Bakersfield?
Yeah, for the intro to Fight Inside of Me. I used this guitar because Haggard cut it in the key of E, I think. Yeah, on his record was the key of E, and that intro was something. And he got to use the low strings, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was going to cut it, we were going to cut it in G, and that would have put me, and it wouldn't have had the fat, the thing, you know. So I had to pull it way up, so I decided to tune the guitar way down so I could have open strings to use. And it gave me the opportunity to play it out of an A position instead of a G position, which I couldn't have, would have been like that. But like that, then I got to. And use a really nice fat low note. And it gave it the meat that I really think it needed to emulate what Merle's record did by doing it quite a bit lower in a different key.
So you mentioned this was in the Flood. Did you notice any kind of change in the sound or anything after Joe had finished repairing it? Or?
Not too much. I don't think it really impacted it. It's just a lot uglier than it used to be. A
few more scars.
Yeah, it's like been whooped pretty bad, but it's holding together, you know. I mean, this body's hollow, and all these cracks and everything were deep, and the back too was, as you can see, crack, and it's just important to me that it got salvaged and got saved and gets to still have a musical life.
Yeah, of course. Is this another one you take on the road?
I do, yeah. I'm not afraid to take an old guitar on the road. My guitar tech's my oldest friend named Benny Garcia, and you would die if you ever tried to mess with him.
Excellent. Well, let's pull another one out and take a look. Yet another Telecaster out of your collection, and this one was used on the album as well.
Yeah, this is a custom 1960 custom, and they were rare. They didn't make very many of these with the binding and sunburst and things like that. And I always wanted to have rosewood board Telecaster. Mm-hmm. All of mine were mostly maple, and I just think a rosewood board, I generally prefer it on a Strat to a maple, but not so much on a Telecaster, but I think it sustains more with the rosewood board for some reason than the maple will. I think he'll stay with you just a little bit longer. And for bending, more from a blues place, things like that, this is a fun guitar to play. This was a friend of mine who unfortunately took his life the year of the Flood, 2010, took his own life. His name was Will Owsley. And I bought this from him to try to help him out in a rough stretch, and told him, I said, look, I'll hang on to it and get back on your feet. Come get it. And unfortunately, he never did get back and in a good spot. So it's got a purpose of being a great Telecaster, but it's also got a purpose of keeping me close to an old friend.
Sure.
I tune it down to E flat. It's a half step lower. I played it about six or eight different Telecasters on that record. I just, once again, this one has a little bit different spank. I think I probably played this one on Tonight the Bottle Let Me Down. And just for, you know, like I said, the 60s model Telecasters had a different kind of honking them, a different mid-range than the Blackguards for some reason, and sound a little more honky-tonk.
So finally, what I want to ask you about, and then we've kind of looked through some of the guitars you've on the record, is the studio we're in here. So you affectionately call it the house, because it's literally part of your house. So tell me a little bit about how this studio kind of came together, and what, you know, made you decide, I need to build something you know, so I can roll out of bed and hit record.
Well, as the technology has changed over the years, you know, it's something I never thought I would have as a studio in my house. I'm just not so sure I ever wanted to have the music world in my house, you know. Just, I wanted my house to be a safe haven, you know, to some degree. But as technology changed, I thought, now's a good time. You don't need a lot of real estate space to be able to make great quality recordings. And I get asked to do an awful lot of stuff on other people's records. I've always been a session player and a session singer, even throughout my solo career success. I never wanted to change and be any different than I ever was. So I kept doing all that stuff. And with all the requests I would get, I thought, well, it'd be pretty convenient if I could just do it from home. Mm-hmm. You know, you can send the files, you can do this, you can do your work and send it back to whoever wants you to do it. And it just made a ton of sense. So I thought I'd try to put a studio in my house, but nothing major. You know, strictly probably more of an overdub type thing where I could do my vocals, I could do guitar parts and not tracking and all that, but just the little stuff. And I got started on the thought of doing it, and this room that we're in was actually two rooms that we knocked the wall out and put a beam up and made twice as much space. We dropped the floor a couple of feet, picked up a lot of ceiling height, and I made the mistake of going to Sheryl Crow's house in the process of building this place, and she had a studio at her house, you know, and it had a Neve board and a lounge and in her house, and I was just blown away. And I got to thinking, I said, well, if I do it the way I'm planning on doing it, I think I'll have to wear headphones all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure. And so I doubled the size of the board, and then I built an extra room onto the side of this room for an overdub space. And we wound up, you know, it wound up working brilliantly in that all the musicians can come in this big room and we can track, put the drums in there, put the singer in the hall, piano's in the living room, there's a B3 in the living room with a Leslie in the closet, and we just take over the whole house. And I'm married to the perfect woman. Amy loves music and loves people in the house, so it doesn't, it's never going to be an issue with her. Mm-hmm. So it's fun to have, it's actually been the greatest thing I could ever have dreamed, is to have music and the people that make music in my house.
Yeah, as mentioned, so when you first designed this, it was kind of just for an overdub and fact. But is this the first project you've kind of fully done in this house?
No, I've actually done several records in here. Mm-hmm. I did my last record in here. I produced an Ashley Monroe record in here, a Leanne Rimes record in here. The group Paul and I both play with called the Time Jumpers, a Western swing band, plays every Monday night here in Nashville at a club called Third and Lindsley. Really neat Western swing band. Got nominated for a couple of Grammys this year with our record that we made here. My daughter's got a record coming out soon, hopefully, that we made in here. And a ton of different sessions, you know, mm-hmm. of people coming by wanting me to sing on something or play on something. And I just I had the most fun ever. We did a session for William Shatner the other day, and he's doing a kind of a reading spoken word record with music behind him, and it's so bizarre, but it was so much fun. You know, it's just really.
What'd you play with him? What'd you play behind him as he was espousing?
I played an acoustic solo, you know, and doubled it with a mandolin that's real ethereal and mm-hmm. kind of spooky sounding and whatever, and a lot of fun stuff I've done in here. I did a duet with Earl Klug in here, a guitar duet, and just having the time of my life in here.
Well, thank you so much for inviting us in your place and talking about some guitars.
Great to have you.
Mm-hmm. This is Jason Shadrick with PremierGuitar.com.